What's up, everybody? Welcome to Draft Chat. This is episode number 161. My name is Zach. I'm one of your hosts, and joining me, as per usual, Ben Fisher. What's up, dude?
Not too much. I'm prepared to take the ring into Mordor today. That's what's happening. So, are all you right, coming? Well,
I'll join. You've got my axe. So, before we do, of course, our usual housekeeping. If you're not already in the Discord, do check that out. It's the best place to be to chat all things MTG. Chat with us. Discuss your trophies, discuss your picks, all that sort of nonsense. Link to that is in our episode description as well as on our Twitter page. And if you'd like to support the show directly, you can do so on Patreon at patreon.com/draftchaffpod. Huge, huge thanks to each and every one of our supporters over there. We're beyond grateful for all of you. Perks over there include things like our Draft Doctor series, stickers, show notes, our pre-show recordings, and our Draft Chaff hero cards signed by us and sent to you in the mail. So again, you can check that out at patreon.com/draftchaffpod. Now, before we get into this, normally there will be an ad read right about here-ish. I did want to just throw out, get some input from the listener. If you are interested in something where we could prevent you from hearing the ad for like a fee or something like that, if you wanted to do that, if that interests you, ways to get around hearing ads, let us know in the Discord. Love to hear about it. All right, on to our crack draft type thing. Ben, what you got?
We've got another pack one, pick one here. One that's kind of relevant to today's episode. So we've got first up here, a Snarling Warg. 4 mana, 3/4 menace. Gets 1/0 if you have an orc or goblin. It's whatever. It's a 4-drop. Sometimes it's fine. You know, these like 4 mana menace cards are usually just whatever. Sometimes they get you. Sometimes they just get killed. Endrider of Gondor is up. This one's good. Had a pretty cool blue-white deck with 2 copies of Prince Imrahil the Fair and then a couple Endriders of Gondor. It's a nice little curve there. Make a 1/1 and draw a card on ETB. But this is a pretty good one. I like as many as I can get in my white decks. Next up, Torment of Golem. That's a 4-drop. I'll take over the Warg any day. This is kind of like a 2/2 with a Thoughtseize staple to it. You know, not as good because you don't get it on turn 1 or 2, but getting to see your opponent's thing and play around the creature counter spells while you're at it, pretty solid. This next one, Warbeast of Gorgoroth. Weirdly good. You know, this is actually the 5-drop that I find myself wanting more often than not, especially in black red. The fact that it makes it when it dies, you get a mass 2. And usually by that time, it almost always seems that when this thing is about to die, there's no army on the battlefield. So like getting the 2/2 is actually pretty big. I don't know if they tend to trade off by that point or I don't know. This is an annoying one to deal with.
Yeah, this is frequently a card that isn't just going to hit, like get eaten by removal either. Like it's not quite good enough that you feel good throwing good removal at it. So you can also kind of find ways to force a scenario where this is going to die when you have no armies.
Yeah. Sometimes the bad removal actually answers this pretty well. Bewitching Leechcraft and the black one, Morgul Knife Wound. They both do a pretty good job. We've got Cast into the Fire. I hate having to play this card, but sometimes you just got to, you know, put a copy in your blue-red spells deck because you didn't get there on red playables because it was cut or something. This is the 1 and a red, deal 1 to each of up to 2 target creatures or exile target artifact. A couple times I have just sniped people's like Horn of Gondor with this or other, like I hit a Doors of Durin with this once when my opponent was like top decking. They slam the Doors of Durin, they go to attacks and they're like, yes, I'm finally back in this. And I was like, is that thing an artifact? Okay, yeah, I'm fine. Next up, we've got Lash of the Balrog. That's the 1 mana, well, kind of 5 mana, destroy target creature, or you can pay just 1 and sack something. I wish you could sack an artifact to pay for this, like sacking treasures or things like that would be pretty good. It's just the club that you can do that, the improvised club that you can sack artifacts. It'd be kind of cool if you could sack the Wizards Rockets to this. Sacking Wizards Rockets to the club is one of my favorite little combos in the set. This one's fine, you know, best in black, red or black, blue, but, you know, you still play it. Actually, black, white makes good use of this too. Really, I guess just put it in a black deck, could be happy. Here's a good creature to sack to it. Ithilien Kingfisher, the 3 mana 2/1 flyer. When it dies, draw a card. Done that a handful of times. I had a lot of success early in the format with blue black, but I hardly ever get good blue black decks these days. Everyone just knows that the colors you want to be in.
Yeah, this is a card too that has felt interestingly like kind of mid. I was expecting it to be a little bit better than it is, I think, when I first saw it. And I think that's because there are a bunch of random creatures with reach in this format. And, you know, a 2/1 just doesn't really stack up very often.
Yeah, I mean, it's a 3 mana 2 power flyer. Sometimes you can get there with this. This does make a good ring bearer in the late game because it's a card that you don't mind dying. So, you know, what are they going to do? Point a removal spell at it? Like, you know, you kind of want that anyway. It dies into a card.
That's true.
We've got Fog on the Barrow Downs. This is just, Honestly, between this and the Hobbit Sting, I usually take the Hobbit Sting over it, but sometimes your white decks, you just got to play one of these. Look, there's Lash of the Balrog. There's like good sack and fling effects. So you don't love putting too many of these. Plus, it costs 3 mana instead of the usual. I feel like we usually get pacifisms for 2 now. And this one doesn't even shut off activated abilities. Oh, man, I put this on a Sirith Ungol patrol once and forgot that it didn't shut off activated abilities. And I was like, yep, I'm like a red-white beatdown deck. I've got them at like 5. I'll put this on their 4 or 5. And then they just started sacking all their stuff and drawing cards and making food. And I was like, oh, this did not work out well. And our last common here, oh, sorry, 2 more. Mirimir Guardian, the 3-mana 4/2. When it dies, the ring tempt 2. And Many Partings, the 1 green sorcery, get a basic and a food. Yeah, green commons, not looking to take those early. Where are you at here?
Probably Torment of Golem. It's kind of a weird card to first pick, but I think just on bare power, like just on rate alone, it's probably the best card in the pack so far.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I did actually have a deck with 3 Torment of Golem and 2 Pelargir Survivor, the 2-mana 1/3 that taps your mana to cast instants and sorceries. That was a pretty cool thing. Having Torment of Golem as a 3-drop is excellent.
Definitely.
But hopefully our uncommons can save us, because this isn't the most exciting first pick. No like super strong removal spells or anything either. Here we've got an Oath of the Greyhose to start off. That's the 4-mana. You and target opponent each make a food, then they lose 3 and you make a treasure. And then you make 3 tapped 1/1 white flyers. White and black flyers, I think. The spirits. Really good card. I mean, 4-mana, make 3 tapped 1/1 flyers is a good rate. You know, you'd always put that in the deck. This is a little worse because they have time to prepare for it. You know, they can find their cast into the fire, or maybe they're not going to cast their fear fire foes until after that trigger resolves. I like this specifically in black white. I think that one leverages the token making the most. Sometimes you have the bat that, like, when tokens enter, it drains them, or, you know, you just sack other stuff. I don't really love this in, like, blue-black. I don't feel like it's on Vector. I feel like it's not what it's trying to do. I'll put this in a black-red deck sometimes if I'm a little lacking in power or ways to close out the game. But 3-1-1 flyers is real. We've got Gift of Strands. No thanks. Nope. Hate to give a gift back, but for the 4-mana aura, it's got flash, gives 3/3, and ETB Scry 2. I would never even put this in a Scry deck. You know, this is just, I think I blew out one person that played this, like on their 2/2 or something, and it just looked embarrassing. And our last uncommon here is Frodo Baggins. Big one. That's the green-white 1/3. They're really, really good ring bearer.
Yeah, I mean, unsurprisingly, if they made Frodo Baggins a bad ring bearer, it would have been big flavor fail.
Our bear here is Legolas Master Archer, the 1-green-green 1/4 with reach. And whenever you cast a spell that targets it, you put a 1/1 counter on him. And whenever you cast a spell that targets one of your opponent's things, you bite with Legolas's power. You get to deal damage equal to it to some creature your opponent controls.
Also, not a bad ring bearer.
Yeah, actually.
At least to start.
Yeah, this one, I don't know, green needed a bit of a power bump in this set, and 3-mana 1/4s are not exactly that.
Not quite there, yeah.
Yeah, this one kind of has heroic in a fun way. I love a good heroic card, but, you know, there's not a lot of pump spells I'm looking to point at Legolas. This one really is good with the fight spells, the red-green uncommon, and the Ensphyrian, yeah, friendly rivalry. Those are, you know, obviously great with Legolas. You get to put a counter on him and have him snipe something else. But, looking at this pack, I think I've got maybe a hot take. I don't know. I don't know if this is a hot take here, but I would be picking a green card first. I'd take Frodo.
Yeah, I was between Frodo and Legolas. I think Legolas is interesting, and I haven't gotten to build a deck around him, but I have played against a deck that used it quite effectively, mm-hmm. and it gets really frightening. I mean, it turns all of your spells that target anything really into removal spells at some point.
Yeah.
And you really only need 2 or 3 counters on Legolas to make him kill pretty much everything. So yeah, it makes you want to, it's one of those cards that kind of makes you want to play bad cards to make your good card better, which is not where you want to be in limited, right? So in that way, he does kind of feel like a trap, but I think I'd need more practice to say for sure. I think I'd also kind of lean toward Frodo because it's easier, even though he's a multicolored card, I think he's easier to make work.
Yeah, I wouldn't blame anyone for taking the Oath of the Grey Host here, or even the Torment of Golem out of this pack, I think is actually pretty reasonable. But I would slam the Frodo here, because if you end up in exactly green white, and there's a chance you can, and there's a chance you can get multiple copies of Frodo. If you wind up in one of these green white decks with like 2 to 3 copies of Frodo and you can get him down on turn 2, those decks can do some of the most busted stuff in the format. Some of the scariest starts end up from those, because when it's open, it's really open. You'll get like a pack 3, pick 5, like Aragorn Expedition Captain, whatever his name is, the 3-mana rare. You'll get past like Arwen, who's one of the best cards in the set, though you're in green white. And Frodo, the best thing is whenever you play any other legend, you get tempted. And turns out playing a deck full of legends is actually pretty good. Tempting a bunch is also pretty good. So I think Frodo has the highest potential value to get out of this. Torment of Gollum, you can usually pick up like a handful of those if you're in a black deck. I would take Frodo over Legolas here too, because let's be honest, you're going to wield a Legolas.
Fair enough, I suppose so. All right, on to our Teferi Tibble. This is our Roses and Thorns style segment where Ben and I share a high and a low from the past week. Ben, what's up?
Not too much. Actually, right before recording, I got back from the beach, so that was fun. Got to hang out, see some friends I hadn't seen in a while. That was always nice. By the time this episode goes up, I'll be in Colorado. It's kind of cool. Recording a little ahead of time, so I will be meandering around the mountains and looking at wildflowers, that type of thing. Should be fun. Going to see a concert in Red Rocks. So, very excited for that. It's actually Camp, C-A-A-M-P. Cool band. Kind of like somewhere in like the indie rock sphere, maybe a little country leaning, which is, it's whatever. They're good. I like Camp. Not have been my top pick for what I would have seen there, but you know, it's up there. I would have picked like Hozier or something, but for the true vibes, it's going to fit the mood for sure. My tibble is that by this time, I expect to encounter some sort of flying issues. I don't know. It just seems like everyone's encountering flight issues. I had a friend get trapped in the airport for over 24 hours, like 2 weeks ago. So hoping that doesn't happen to me. But the whole thing of flying, it's all just, I don't fly very often. So to me, it's fun, but it's a whole hassle to it.
Definitely. Yeah, it can suck. And Colorado is not the shortest flight either.
Yeah, I don't know how long it is. I keep forgetting. I think it's like 4 or 5 hours, but I don't know. We'll see how it goes. Maybe it's, you know, clean flying, smooth sails the whole way, but I know better. Something's probably going to go wrong.
Yeah, I don't think they put sails on planes, but maybe you'll have one of those. I don't remember what the name of the ship that Count Dooku uses to get away with, but
like a solar sail. Yeah.
Solar sail, yeah. For me, my Teferi is that Commander Masters is looking really fun. Ben and I were talking about it before the show. There are some cool reprints in the set, some cool new cards in the set as well. And they went pretty creative with some of the pre-cons this time around, which I'm excited about. So it does look fun. I think Ben and I are going to play at the launch party, which seems to be a draft instead of like traditional sealed, which should be fun. So yeah, looking forward to that. My Tybalt this week is vet bills. I've had to take my dog to the vet twice this month, and all told, I've put in about $1,000 for functionally nothing.
Jeez.
She hasn't had anything actually done yet, and mostly that has been blood work and a couple of painkillers, and she needs to get dental work, and the estimate for the dental work she needs had $1,000 range on it. So it's from $1,600 up to almost $2,800.
That's ridiculous.
I'm less like, oh goodness. Yeah. So I'm not looking forward to having to pay all those things. But you know, I guess having a dog is in some cases somewhat like having a kid. So she's cost me far less than a child would at this point. So
true. Yeah.
I guess I'll take it. Oh, the other thing, I think part of the problem. So I took her to the vet in the first place because she's been acting strangely, mostly like very anxious looking, like shaking a lot and panting a lot. Her ears have been pinned back, which is kind of like an anxiety looking thing. Which she normally does during thunderstorms, but she's been doing it lately for the last like 2 weeks. She's been doing it in the middle of the day, even in the morning when the weather's fantastic. So something's been off. One thing the vets suggested might be the problem, or at least aiding the problem, is I lost her crate recently. And so she doesn't like have a quote unquote home anymore. Although I have a bed in the same spot. It could have something to do with that. The other thing is she thinks it might be like arthritis or something like that. But one day I was driving down to my dad's. This is just like a fun anecdotal story. I was driving down to my dad's to see him for Father's Day. And I got the dog in the car. And when I was getting the dog in the car, I had set the crate down on the side of the road. I got the dog in the car. I got in the car and drove away. And I didn't notice I didn't put the crate in the car until I got to my dad's house, went in the trunk to get the crate, and it wasn't there. I was like, where the heck did the... Oh, crap.
Well,
I just left it on the side of the road.
You know, like Jersey City, Hoboken area, I'm sure it was still there when you got back, right?
You know, surprisingly, it wasn't.
Weird.
That thing probably got snatched up like 5 minutes after I left.
Yeah, it was gone.
All right, on to our listener question of the week. And this week, Ben's got a question for you, listener.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of like a travel episode. We're recording in advance. Zach's doing some traveling upcoming too. So we actually were wondering for the listeners, you can answer in the random section. What is the coolest place you've ever traveled? Tell us about it. Give us reasons we should go there for our next vacation, that sort of thing.
All right, on to our main topic. This week, we're talking about something... Well, we haven't really done a mechanic-specific breakdown before, so Ben, why don't you give us an introduction here?
Right. Well, anyway, I will take it. I will take the ring to Mordor, though I do not know the way. And listener, you might not know the way either, but that's why you're listening, right? We're going to tell you the way to take the ring to Mordor successfully. Ring bearing is actually the most important mechanic in this set, and with actually a little bit of vector theory, you can figure out why. Before we talk about, you know, the specific vector, let's refresh some of like the do's and don'ts for a while. It's been a while since we've gone super deep into vector theory. So as a general refresher, maybe for those that haven't heard this before, I've got plenty of articles on it on Cardsphere. Feel free to check those out. And we can link
them. And we've done a few episodes on it as well.
Yeah. So vector theory is the idea that you can analyze cards and decks pretty easily by looking at what we would define to be their vector, which is what they want to do, what the direction is that they're pointing in. So, for example, that situation I described earlier, I had a blue-white deck with two copies of Prince Imrahil the Fair. The deck that that card goes well in, the vector that that direction is, it's a draw two, right? Prince Imrahil is at its best when, you know, you're drawing two cards a turn. And I guess a card analysis... side effect of vector theory is that you don't really ask when cards are good or bad. You ask at what point is this card at its best and how does that compare to other cards at their best. So for example, Prince Imrahil, you could certainly craft a blue-white deck that's controlling and doesn't draw multiple cards a turn that well. And then it's just junk in that deck, right? It's off vector. But if you have a blue-white deck that is super good at drawing multiple cards a turn, maybe you have a bunch of Eren Rider of Gondor, or you have multiple copies of Arwen's Gift or Birthday Escape, and then maybe some other, you know, supporting cards, then you would say that's a very vector synergistic deck.
Yeah, the other thing we like to look at when it comes to vector theory is we kind of look at the vectors in sort of two different lights. There's the vector that the card itself has, which is how well it fits in a certain direction versus how poorly it fits in some other direction. And then there's the vector of the deck as a whole. And so Ben just mentioned a situation where Prince Imrahil is way better in a deck that has XYZ cards, right? Supporting cards. And it's worse in a deck that doesn't have those things. But on its own, looking at the card in a vacuum, you can see just by reading the card, well, this does well in a deck that draws multiple cards a turn. It's probably going to do poorly in a deck that doesn't. It's low costed, well statted for the cost, so it maybe work better in an aggressive deck that leans towards drawing multiple cards. So that kind of helps you see where does this card actually want to go and how can you build a deck around making it get there.
Yeah, and just as a refresher, vectors, we are borrowing this from physics. They have both strength and direction, right? So you might hear us refer to the vector strength of a card, which is, you know, Prince Imrahil is a pretty good payoff for drawing two a turn. Whereas, Knights of Dol Amroth is a weak vector payoff for drawing two cards a turn. There's also the direction of it, which is, you know, kind of what we mentioned. Obviously, Prince Imrahil the Fair has a very different vector direction than, say, Mortar Muster or Mauher, the Uruk-hai captain.
The other thing I like about vector theory in particular is that we, you know, if you think about how vectors work in physics, there are infinite of them in like from a direction perspective, right? You've got all these different directions and every card can technically go in any deck. And so this lets you kind of compare contrast against the performance of a card in a given shell versus just, well, this is a card that belongs in this deck and nowhere else. Because we've seen in a lot of ways, some decks actually pop up later in formats because somebody finds out, hey, this card actually fits really well in this archetype, or as we would call a vector, that nobody really saw ahead of time. And it doesn't seem to fit. This is kind of like the blue-green wizards thing in Zendikar Rising, right?
Yeah.
It was a vector that nobody really saw at first, but actually turned out to be very powerful when you figured out which pieces belong there and which pieces actually go in that direction and how strongly they do.
So let's get into some of the vectors of the set. Unlike some sets in recent memory, I found it's actually possible to draft a deck in LTR that is functionally incapable of winning a game. And usually if you just like draft cards, or you know, if you're half asleep and you just draft random cards and you put them in a deck and like march the machine, you'll probably win some games, right? Because maybe you picked up, I don't know, a couple bombs here and there, or a Halo Forager and some good removal spells. You can win some games at that. I have encountered decks in this format that seem virtually unplayable. So here's a curve to imagine. And this is when a deck is actually curving out, but even still unplayable. Imagine you've got Lothlorien Lookout as your 2-drop. That's the 1/3 in green. When it attacks, you scry 1. Then you play turn 3, Aaron Rider of Gondor, the looter. And then you go 4-drop Butterbur Bree Innkeeper, the food maker. Something's obviously pretty wrong here, right? I mean, I just named like 3 decent green-white cards. I've put all 3 of these cards into decks. But when you see all 3 of these curved into each other, you know, what's wrong here?
Yeah, and you're, as you're sitting across the board from somebody who's doing this, you should be thinking, wait, what are they trying to do? What's their goal? Yeah. Because these cards in that order don't tell me their plan. And that's something that vector theory helps a lot with, is what is the plan of my deck and what is my deck actually trying to do?
Yeah, I'd be very confused if I saw this. This is inspired by real life events. And usually when I see this, I go, okay, this person probably doesn't really know how to build a deck in this format. And that's okay. You know, everyone starts somewhere. But if I saw this, I'd be like, okay, I'm going to win this game because my deck actually does something. Although a couple times I have whiffed in this format. Sometimes your draft just doesn't get there. But something is obviously wrong here. We have the 2-drop is a scry vector. The 3-drop is a card draw slash legends vector. And the 4th is a, legends slash food vector. And these don't really play well with each other. There's not even like a common that ties all these together. Like some sets, maybe you can have off vector cards and some, you know, key thing in your deck. For example, I think it was that uncommon that made blue-green wizards really good. There were a couple key commons and uncommons. It was like an artifact, like to let you scry or draw cards with, or deal damage with wizards. I don't know. It was some like uncommon payoff that doesn't exist here. So that curve, you're just going to lose the game every time if you curve that out. Now, compared to this curve, something I did this morning, actually. 2-drop Prince Imrahil the Fair. 3-drop Aaron Rider of Gondor. Then 4-drop Protector of Gondor. That's the 4-mana ETB make a 3-3 and a 1-1. I mean, this is strong, right? Assuming your opponent doesn't interact or like kill the Imrahil in response to the Aaron Rider. You made a token. You're setting up for some like flicker effect stuff. You're establishing like a good board state and you're going wide, right? You made a 2/1/1 tokens over the course of that, you know, reasonable 3-card curve. And that's just commons and an uncommon, right? This would be a pretty strong little curve out for this draw to go wide vector, right? And this is present mostly in blue white. But this still isn't even the best you can do in this format, because now that we've found a good vector direction to be in, like we're consistently along one vector, now it comes down to power. Is this the most powerful vector in the set? Not even close. Here's a better thing to imagine. 2-drop, you go March from the Black Gate to amass. 3-drop, you go Dunland Crabane and then swing for 4. And then 4-drop, you go Claim the Precious plus Birthday Escape to make the Crabane a looter. Boom. Like, how do you lose that game? You have like a 5-5 on turn 4 and you're attacking with a flying 1-1 looter that can't be blocked. You're just not losing that game. And imagine you curve out that against the person that goes Lothlorien Lookout into Aaron Rider into Butterbur. That game would be a joke.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you have sort of comparisons, right, as well between what is the strongest version of a vector in the format, maybe something like the blue-white deck that Ben described a moment ago, versus the strongest or maybe even weaker versions of other vectors, because there is some play there. If you find that figuring out the vector of a deck in a given format is difficult, then maybe other players do as well. And so you may be able to craft a really strong vectored deck in maybe what's not the strongest vector in the format, but a really tight, strong version of that vector can beat out a lot of other decks because they just aren't as tight or as strong. The other thing I want to mention quickly about vector theory is this also kind of lets us break the habit I think most Magic players have, myself included. I still fall into this camp. The habit of looking at every deck in terms of colors, because Vector theory doesn't really care about the colors at all. It cares more about what is the deck trying to do and what are the cards in that deck doing to help push the deck in that direction. And so when we do our format breakdowns, we still talk about the colors because that's the way Magic sets are made. We have the signpost uncommons, right? Those cards that are multicolored uncommons that show you kind of what that color pair is trying to do. That's how Magic sets are designed these days. But we typically try to break from that a little bit and talk about more of the vector direction than the colors themselves. Because again, with an example like Blue-Green Wizards, sometimes decks pop up that weren't expected. And that's because of a new vector is found, not because new colors showed up.
Yeah, or even consider how you can use this to analyze colorless cards, right? File of Galadriel, the 3-mana rock that taps from out of any color and says when you're at 5 or less life, you gain twice as much. And whenever you draw a card empty-handed, you draw 2 instead. Vector theory pretty easily helped us figure out that that's actually great in red-white aggro, like red-black aggro, where you draft a super low curve. And it's this thing that draws cards and gains life, and it seems like it's some kind of commander junk or like a blue-green deck wants this. But if you can actually get empty-handed as fast as possible, then this thing lets you draw 2 cards a turn. And then if you draw 2 cards a turn, play them both, and then attack with a looter, a ring bearer, then you draw 2 off the ring bearer, and then you only have to discard 1. You can do some really cool stuff with it in an aggressive deck, even though it's a mana rock that costs 3. And that I think a lot of people would write off as like, oh, my red-white deck doesn't want a 3-mana mana rock. But that's not how you should think of it, according to vector theory. So I've actually had a bit of a change of heart since the start of the format. I actually wrote a whole article about how a mass is one of the keys to winning. I still believe that. I still believe that a mass is particularly strong and that's why the Grixis colors are some of the best in the format. But I think the reasoning behind my belief has changed. I originally thought it was because a mass made multiple bodies. And it seemed that trading those off productively against the more assertive vectors led to you having stability in the long game in the Grixis colors. And then you could just kind of trade off a bunch. And then you get to a point where the board is basically empty and you have 4 cards in hand and your opponent has 0. And that's a good place to be in. Although now I've changed my mind. I think now it's because it makes it so that you always have a body to act as your ring bearer. I think that might have been the hidden, value in a mass in some of these similar cards. So, for example, that little curve I mentioned earlier, Dunlin Crabane into Birthday Escape, right? Dunlin Crabane makes 2 bodies, assuming you don't have a mass token already, makes the 2/2 army and the 1/1 flyer. And if you like Birthday Escape a bunch of times, now your bird is an unblockable looter, forever. You can eventually turn it into a 4/1 when it gets to the last chapter of Ringbearer. And who's going to spend a good removal spell like Smite the Deathless or Ranger's Firebrand or something on a 1/1 flyer that already got its ETB value? Like that's ridiculous. So the fact that these things enter and make multiple bodies, other things like Gothmog, Morgul Lieutenant, the 4-mana 3/3 ETB make a 1/1. Warbeast of Gorgoroth, when we mentioned earlier, the 5-mana 5/4 that dies into a 2/2. These kind of, they don't so much go wide as they do go steady or consistently. Amass is good at that, right? It makes sure you can always have an Amass army. These types of things make sure that you always have a body in play to serve as your ring bearer. And I think it's not the Amass that's actually the key to the format, but it's the fact that Amass helps you be a better ring bearing deck. That's what makes these decks best in the format.
Yeah, I agree. I found that anytime you can just reliably come up with a stat line, like it doesn't even really matter what the stat line is, but when you're amassing 1 or 2, a lot of times those creatures can't be blocked anyway when they become ring bearers by much at all. And you get a card like Gothmog that also gives them all death touch and you're really off to the races. But the reliability of, hey, I have a creature that I can either move the ring to or give the ring in the first place. The reliability on those decks is really what makes them tick.
So as our title kind of implies, carrying the ring to Mordor is key to winning in this format. And the Grixis colors do have the best tempting spells. Tempting is present in all colors, but the fact that it's stapled to some of the best black, red, and blue cards that you want in your decks anyway, just makes it great. So for example, Claim the Precious is the key to this. That's the 1 black destroy target creature, and the ring tempts you. Super clean, super easy. I mean, it's just murder with a small upside, right? A card that sometimes you wouldn't even play in some modern limited formats. You prefer like 1 or 2 mana answers instead. You can't jam your deck full of 3 mana answers. In some formats you can, though. In this one you can. In this format you'd play as many copies of Claim as you can get. Ranger's Firebrand, the uncommon red shock. Still hate that that's a sorcery, but you know, whatever. Gollum's Bite, the -2/-2 for 1. Other than that one, it doesn't tempt you right away. You have to flash it back from the graveyard. Glorious Gale in blue, countering a legend for 2 mana and then getting tempted. All these cards, they kind of just point you in this good vector direction because the cards you want to put in your deck anyway, right? I've pack one, pick one, claim the precious. And then there's other good cards like Sam's Desperate Rescue, Gandalf, Friend of the Shire, Rohirrim Lancer, the 1-1 Menace is a really good ring bearer. The fact that it dies to give someone else the ring is pretty good too. The Nazgul, even in blue, Horses of the Brunnen, pretty good. Even some ones that you wouldn't expect to have it stapled to. Fiery Inscription makes something the ring bearer. So maybe if you played like, I don't know, an Airborne Flamesmith, or sometimes you can get down a Rohirrim Lancer first, then the Fiery Inscription, the 3-mana enchantment, whenever you cast an instant or sorcery, you deal to. Those all work along this vector as well. So these are all within the Grixis colors. These are all cards I'm happy to put in my deck anyway. Even if these didn't have the Ring Bearer text on them, I would still want them for the decks because they're just that good. But these are all putting up very strong numbers on 17 lands. So I think that kind of confirms my hypothesis. Ring Bearing, it's good, you know? It's good to have a looter.
All right, so you mentioned a lot about Grixis colors. There are 2 colors distinctly missing from that wedge. What about green? Because we do see a lot of good green tempt cards in the format, but there aren't really a ton of them, it seems, and green overall is pretty weak. So what are you thinking?
Yeah, I guess before green, just a side note about white. It's fine. You can play white. It's whatever. You know, just be aggressive. There's some efficient creatures. There's ways to tempt. But green is the one that's kind of on everyone's minds, right? It's no secret you don't want to be starting with like a green card in this format, but it's not totally unplayable. You can just focus on the cards that have ring bearer vector strength or cards that just have generically strong vector strength in any direction. And then you can still get there with your green decks. For example, I'm never passing pack one, pick one Radagast. Radagast the Brown is ridiculous. It's basically unbeatable. I don't think I've ever actually beaten that card, actually. So we've got stuff like Dunedain Rangers, Enraged Huron, Miramir Guardian. These all stand out as ways to get tempted in green. And unsurprisingly, these are some of the cards that are performing best on 17 lands. Bombadil's Song is another one. I think that one's a little too situational, a little too weak. There are some just solid green commons, some generically solid ones that don't even tempt. Woe's Pathfinder is the backbone of a lot of the multicolored decks, but can also just be good in any green deck. Generous Ent, the Cycler, you're still going to play one or two of those. One that I was surprised to see doing well on 17 lands was Bag End Porter. It's the 4-mana 4/4. But thinking about it, sometimes your opponent plays a 4-mana 4/4 and there's just nothing you can do about it.
Yeah, cards like Old Man Willow have really gotten me in the past too, because once you get any sort of power toughness above a certain threshold, and I think that threshold is 4/4,
yeah,
it gets really difficult to deal with anything. There just aren't very many large creatures in the format. There aren't very many removal spells that are completely unconditional. So it does get difficult to stack up when your opponent's playing a bunch of really beefy creatures.
Yeah. Actually, as I was writing our show notes, I was playing against a green-black deck, and it was a disgusting deck. They had Old Man Willow, Gollum, Radagast the Brown, Shelob, all on the battlefield at once. I wrote, I can't win in the show notes, because I absolutely could not. Unfortunately, I was playing with my that blue-white deck I mentioned earlier. And this is actually the deck where the game where I got to go turn 2 Imrahil into turn 3 Eren Rider into turn 3 Protector. And this green deck just made it look like a joke. I mean, they were drawing a million cards, tempting a bunch off of Gollum. It went, just because you open a green card doesn't mean you shouldn't, you know, look at it at all, especially now that the meta has kind of changed. Now that people are drafting the Grixis colors more heavily because they want, you know, to be tempting and taking all these high value cards anyway, you're not going to get like pick 3 claim the precious anymore, or like pick 5 rally or pick 6, all these other nonsense cards, like Mortar Muster, those even go early. So you do need to know how to draft green in this format. And it's the tempting cards. So just a side note about tempting. The first chapter is whatever. You don't care about it too much. You can usually put it on your smallest thing, make something unblockable, or you put it on something situational. For example, I had a situation come up where my opponent had a 3/4 and a 9/9. So I made my 4/4 the ring bearer, which meant it could attack underneath the 9/9 and pass the 3/4. You know, making sure I could still get in for maximum amount of damage. I could have put it on a 2/2, guaranteeing that it gets in, but, you know, putting on the 4/4, they weren't going to jump with the 3/4. So that worked. So you usually put on your smallest thing, but not always. Chapter two is the real reason you should be a ring bearer. And the real reason that once a thing gets to chapter two, I usually point a removal spell at it or try to lock it down or make a board where they can't attack with it efficiently anymore. Having a looting creature is kind of like what you mentioned on the last week's episode. It is this format's smoothing mechanism, right? Like Foretell or Kicker. It is the thing that kind of smooths out the game, where it turns your bad draws into good draws. It saves you when you're having mana issues. If you don't have a ring bearer, you'll sometimes have these experiences in this format where you feel like your deck just didn't work at all, where your opponents did. Think about the times that that has happened. There's a good chance they had a ring bearer on chapter two and you didn't. Chapter three is whatever, you know, you can get people to block sometimes. A trick I found with this, when you slip on the ring, that's the flicker effect, and then also tempts you, which is nice. If you have a creature, it gets blocked and it'd be about to die to like a death toucher or something, like the spider, you can flicker your thing and chapter three of the ring will still make them sack their thing because it did get blocked by your ring bearer.
Yeah, I've gotten got by that third chapter quite a few times.
And chapter four is obviously great. If you can instant speed some ways to tempt, then sometimes you can just hit your opponent for a free bolt in the face out of nowhere. Anywho, back to chatting about green. Green can do all these things still. And the fact that it can establish good board presence, I think Enraged Huron, the 5-mana 4/5 trample ETB, the ring tempts you. This is kind of the poster child for it. It's a solid blocker. It can attack through basically anything but a generous ant. And let's be honest, not many people are playing generous ants. And the fact that this thing, by turn five, this will usually get you to the second chapter. If you've built a deck where you're tempting in other ways, other cheaper ways, hopefully, then, you know, just slamming this, it guarantees you got the ring bearer. And that's right about the time in the game where you want to have your ring bearer on chapter two. Okay, so some of the specific colors. Green, red, it's kind of funny. Usually if someone playing green, red, you know, they went pack one, pick one, Doors of Durin. Card is good, but the deck around it usually isn't. I think it's fine if you can pick up a couple of Woes Pathfinders. Curving out your bigger stuff early, like a 4-mana 4/4, like the Bag End Porter or like Strider, those can be fine. But otherwise, green-red is not very scary. Even the looters there aren't great. These creatures tend to be bigger, stuff that gets killed by, you know, solid removal spells anyway. And a bigger creature is not always the best ring bearer, right? Because it can't attack through stuff, susceptible to double blocks, can get blown out pretty easily by combat tricks, things that little unblockable ring bearers don't have to worry about. Green blue, we've mentioned before, it can be awesome, but this one doesn't care too much about ring bearing. I think the Scry vector can actually compete with ring bearing as a vector that can, you know, get you wins. If you are super deep in the Scry vector, your deck actually has an engine unto itself and it doesn't need the ring to get you there.
Green white's obviously kind of busted. We talked about Frodo being the linchpin in that vector already, just from our cracker draft. But I think if you've got a way to reliably cast Frodo on turn two, then you're pretty set. You do need other legends in the deck. And so Frodo is a card that, from a vector theory perspective, we see very strong in a very particular direction, but also needs a lot of support. So by itself, mm-hmm. it's kind of weak in any direction, really. That said, if you can consistently put him down on turn two and follow up with legend, you're probably winning most of those games.
Yeah, I mean, Frodo's a great ring bearer, right? Usually he's attacking on turn three as a looter. And, you know, green-white, sometimes green-white doesn't often get a looter, right? So green-white, in just any format, backed up by the card smoothing that you get from Frodo, it just ends up with these super clean, efficient draws where it just curves out perfectly into something like an Enraged Huron, and then you can just attack through for a million damage. Frodo's eating all their 1/1s and eventually draining them for three as like a 4/3 unblockable. So that was the reason that I made that pack one, pick one in today's crack draft. And the reason that I would take Frodo pretty highly. So, you know, that can make for a pretty scary turn three. So big picture, the ring is where you want to be. It's the vector that I think is the strongest in the set. A mass is still good, you know, just put a bunch of mass cards in your deck. You'll have a good time. But I've been kind of evaluating packs in two ways. I look for any of the good Grixis cards. And then if I don't see them, I look for anything that says tempt on it. And if there's anything that says tempt on it, I say, all right, how can I make this work? Slip on the ring, I've actually had a lot of success with, where I had a couple good black-white decks where I picked up like Protectors of Gondor, Eren Riders of Gondor, both great flicker targets. Plus, the ring tempts you as part of the slipping on the ring. So then you wind up with a good ring bearer too. And I've been moving more into green. I've been, you know, putting it off. Oh, I also did some experimenting with Dreadful as the Storm. The 3-mana instant makes something base power and toughness 5/5. I actually tried treating it like a burn spell, where I put it in a blue-red deck and would just fire it off on like an army that was getting into my opponent, where I get to make something the Ring Bearer and I get in for 5 extra points of damage and like a kind of burn style. It kind of worked. I'd like to try that a little more, but I'm now moving into testing out green and taking cards like Enraged Huron, because you can pretty reliably get those like 8th or 9th pick. And if you're getting solid cards from your deck, 8th or 9th pick, then you're probably in a good spot. So the meta continues to evolve, still testing it out, still figuring out how to make this these green cards work. But right now, I think the real way to do it is to take green cards and say tempt on them.
Well, that about does it for us this week. Thank you so much for listening. Do check out the Discord if you haven't already. The link to that is in the episode description as well as on our Twitter page. And if you'd like to support the show directly, you can do so on Patreon at patreon.com/draftchaffpod. Thanks, folks, and we'll catch you next week.
Later. So I mentioned I was at the beach right before this. A friend actually, I think her dad worked on the boardwalk or something, got a big crate full of hats. And these hats were going to get tossed anyway because there's something kind of funny about them. Check out this hat. I'm going to hold it up to you and maybe you can convey to the listener. I know it's going to be flipped, but...
Saw it almost instantly. Yeah.
Notice anything weird about that? Maybe you'd share with the listener going on here. It's a very nice hat. It's like a baseball hat. It's pink. It's got a cool logo on it.
Yeah, it's got like a nice patch on it that says the town that we're from, but the state is wrong.
Yeah, it has New York printed instead of New Jersey. And I don't know, it's kind of sick, right? Like, this is an awesome hat. How often do you get a hat for a place that doesn't exist?
Yeah, what's the resale value on that misprint?
I'd have to check out the MTG stocks people. Maybe they know. I don't know. Even just from like having to grade that ring that I opened, I've learned there's this whole separate sphere of Magic, I guess, content enjoyers that are all focused on collectibles and misprints and stuff like that. Honestly, this stuff contains multitudes. Even just like seeing some threads on Reddit about like Commander, it's like they're talking about an entirely different game.